MacCast, Wednesday, March 30th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you are having a great week. Things are going pretty well here in the MacCast studios, aka my closet, which is actually where I record. I don't know if I've ever talked about that on this show. I'm a regular on the Mac show over on the British Tech Network, and they always tease me that I'm a little bit like Harry Potter in my cupboard under the stairs. So we can call it the cupboard studio. Not under the stairs, though, because I only have a single story. A single story house. But hey, how you doing? I am doing pretty good, if you can't tell. And we have a pretty good show lined up for you this week, despite the fact that really last week was all the big announcements with the iPhone SE and the iPad Pro 9.7 inch. We're going to do a little bit of updating of those announcements on this show, including talking about some of the stuff that didn't get announced that we thought might be announced. MacBooks, a little bit. There may still be some hope left for those. Apple's got another show coming, TV show that they're working on. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Apple Pay is getting expanded to the internet. And we're going to talk about some of the new adapters, also potentially the next generation iPhone. Some people having some issues with iOS 9.3 update and more on what's happening with the DOJ unlocking of the iPhone in the San Bernardino case, along with new Apple Store opening up with some new features and designs, and talking a little bit about how things are going with those iPhone SEs and iPad Pros in terms of sales. We've got all that, and then we're going to get to a lot of your feedback this week and comments. I had a lot of great stuff come to me in email and over voicemail after the last episode, and so we'll be getting into all of that in just a minute. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, actually a new sponsor here on the MacCast, and it's iMazing. And if you haven't heard about iMazing, it is a really cool tool. It's a tool that lets you access, or software that lets you access, view, backup, and manage the data on your iOS devices directly. So while iTunes will let you do that for some of your data, what is awesome about iMazing is that it lets you get at just about everything on your iOS device directly without any jailbreaking required. So an often thing I'll get asked about is, hey, can I manage my music and my media on my iPhone? I don't want to have it all loaded in iTunes. I want to be able to load it from other places. I want to manage it from different locations on my desktop. iMazing will let you do that kind of stuff. You can manage and interact with data from messages, from photos and videos, from the music apps, from notes, from contacts, your voicemails, your call history, even the file system. And you can even access all that stuff from your backup files as well. And it all comes with a really familiar Apple-like interface. So you're immediately comfortable when you open up the software and working in it. It allows you to do things asynchronously. So a lot of times when you're pulling a backup, that might take a little while. So you can continue working on other parts of your iOS device while that is happening. It does not slow you down. So it's fast and efficient. You can even, like I said, access and browse those files that are inside your backups. And this is great for recovering individual data files and exporting and re-importing saved data from games and applications and things like that. I've used iMazing to actually do exactly that, not just for my devices, but also for other members of my family. So it's great if you have to do tech support. Again, I've had people ask me, and I think we had this on last week's episode, hey, I want to be able to back up and restore my messages. How can I do that? You can use iMazing to do that. Go in, you can just save threads, free up storage space on your device, and even do that also for things like voicemails. So maybe you want to save those voicemails offline on your Mac. You don't want to have to keep them sitting there on your iOS device eating up space. It'll allow you to do that as well. That and a whole bunch more stuff. You really should check it out, iMazing.com. You can try it completely free. And best of all, when you order, you can get 20% off if you use the coupon code MACCAST. So you get 20% off. And it's just one of those bits of software that's great to have on your Mac. It's a good, useful tool when you want to manage and access and deal with your iOS devices. I've used it to recover saved game data after doing a restore. You can go in there, you can get at those individual files, and again, all without jailbreaking. So happy to have iMazing on as a new sponsor of the MacCast. Make sure you check it out, iMazing.com, and don't forget to use the coupon code MACCAST to get 20% off. And a big thank you to iMazing for their support of the show. Well, if you were disappointed at the announcements last week because maybe you were hoping Apple would do something with their MacBook lineup, you don't have to give up hope, at least not quite yet. Many people were expecting that Apple might update the MacBook line. That didn't happen, but in the latest version of OS X Server, there's actually a tool called System Image Utility. And somebody noticed this week that there seems to be a reference in there to a MacBook that we haven't seen yet, the 12-inch MacBook early 2016 model. It's listed as a target. And I guess what this tool allows you to do is kind of create system disk images that you can use to deploy on various devices. So you can have them tailored specifically for individual Macs, either an iMac or a notebook or what have you. Now, it could be that Apple simply was planning an early 2016 model and has backed off of that and just forgot to remove that reference. Seems unlikely. You would have thought it would have gotten picked up in quality control, but you know, we have had these rumors. We heard rumors last week that Apple's working on some new 13-inch and 15-inch ultra-thin updates for their notebook line. I think those are going to be the new MacBook Pros, but again, the 12-inch MacBook is due for an update as well. I would still really expect the update to happen more around WWDC. That's just my opinion. And that would technically, I think, be a mid-2016 model. So that early 2016 reference is a little bit odd unless Apple really is planning on giving us an update in the next month or so. It could happen. We're looking for the Skylake processor updates. So I don't put that out of the realm of possibility. Also, many people have noted that MacBooks are showing up discounted on Amazon and Best Buy for like $100, $200 off. And that sometimes can be a sign that they're trying to clear out inventory. They're getting ready for a refresh and update. So if that was something you were looking for out of last week's event and maybe were a little bit disappointed by, hang on another month or two. It sounds like those updates could be coming. Hollywood Reporter is saying that Apple has another video series planned for Apple Music. Now, we've already talked on the show about the new series from Dr. Dre, Vital Signs, in which he's going to star and produce. Dr. Dre is one of the co-founders of Beats, which Apple acquired, and that's why we now have Beats Radio. His show is said to be kind of a dark series and loaded with sex and violence, very atypical of what Apple's doing. But luckily, this new show seems to be a little bit more in line, a little bit more tame with respect to Apple's image. The show is a video documentary show called The Score, and it's going to be a show focused on different local music scenes from around the world, kind of focusing on one music scene in each episode. And it's looking like it's going to be a little bit more original, more about music discovery. And they're saying it's a short video documentary in each episode. They don't really define what short means. So I don't know if that's a half hour program, a hour program, or maybe even just like a little 10-15 minute snippet. They say the premiere episode is going to be called Reservation Rap and will center on the music scene emerging from the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota. That's the Ojibwa tribe. And it looks pretty interesting. There's some previews out there, and it's certainly going to tie in with what's going on in Apple Music. They say, along with the show, Apple's going to issue companion playlists, and they're going to highlight the different artists that appear in each episode. So it sounds like a really nice tie-in. Right now, and I didn't even know about this till I read this article, currently Apple offers one serialized content show on Apple Music already called We the Best TV with DJ Khalid. And I have not seen that show. It looks like it's a more of an interview show with various rap artists and R&B artists and things like that. And so we're just seeing Apple kind of have more and more of this video content be announced. Then also this week, it came out that Apple is working on what some are calling their first original TV project. So these first three projects we've already heard about have been kind of centered and look like they're going to be targeted toward Apple Music. It's unclear if this new show is also going to be part of Beats One or the Apple Music thing. It's sounding like it isn't. And this is according to an article in the New York Times. They say this series is going to be a non-scripted series focusing on apps and the app economy. Now, Apple is reportedly working with the artist will.i.am, so there is a little bit of music tie-in there, but also two other executives, Ben Silverman, who was an executive producer in the early days of The Office, and another guy named Howard T. Owens. And Apple did not really provide any details on when, how, or what the specifics of the show would be, but they basically confirmed and said, yes, we're bringing this. And Eddie Q strongly hinted that Apple TV, iPhone, and iPad owners would be able to watch the shows on their devices. So whether or not that'll be some new app or TV channel that is put out through Apple TV, it's unclear at this point. But it sounds like a show that I'd be very interested in watching, knowing a little bit more about the stories behind some of our apps that get built. And it really does seem like for now, Apple is sticking with content that fits inside its wheelhouse, more or less, you know, with the artists from Beats One or doing things that are related to their products and services. They also seem to be looking at shows that are going to feed into what Apple does and help them promote their existing products and services. And I think that's really smart. It's kind of a good way to get into this side of the business. And Apple has said that they're not really looking to do TV production or content and stuff like that in certain interviews. But I think it's certainly a direction that they're exploring and possibly looking at moving into. And I think this is probably a good way to do it, to do these kinds of TV shows and programs. They reportedly also have been producing music videos for some of their artists. And we know they did some of the concert specials, like the recent one for Taylor Swift's tour. And so what I find interesting is now Apple basically has four different programs, at least serialized or multi-episode programs, in the works. And I would imagine we're going to hear about more moving into the future. And then one final thing kind of related to, not directly to TV, but something that will show up on TV, is that Apple announced a deal with Major League Baseball this week that will give it some pretty good exposure for its products. Baseball managers and coaches are going to be issued iPad Pro 12.9 models with rugged cases sporting their team logos that they will use in the dugouts during games to look at highlight reels and gameplays and all sorts of information. The MLB's Advanced Media Division and Apple reportedly teamed up to develop an app called MLB Dugout that will be loaded with content and information for each game. It'll be limited specifically to just seeing the content for the specific manager or coach's team. So they're not going to be able to, you know, spy on what the other team is doing or get at play data. And they'll have them loaded up before the games. They'll be issued and they'll be using those in the dugouts, sort of like what the NFL did with the Microsoft Surface tablets. Hopefully it goes a little bit more smoothly on the PR side for Apple. Microsoft had a little bit of a rough time, but Apple's had a pretty good working relationship with the MLB and their advanced media division since day one. A lot of the MLB content was some of the first sports content showing up on the Apple TV. And I would imagine this is an extension of that relationship. No word on the financial terms, you know, what's going back and forth, but for sure Apple helped do some consulting and development on the app, and also is probably likely providing the iPads for the MLB. But it'll be interesting to see. So when you're watching your favorite game this next season, look for those iPads in the dugout. Recode is reporting that Apple has partners lined up to bring Apple Pay payments to a new place on the web. So far, Apple Pay has been limited to retail point of sale locations and also in-app purchases, specifically through an application API. Now it looks like we might be able to use them on the web. The payments would reportedly be limited, at least at first, to using Safari on devices that have Touch ID, but Apple is also probably looking at other ways to expand that. In the report, they say Apple is considering enabling web-based payments for Safari on the Mac, but it's not certain that would be available at launch. I would imagine one of the technical limitations is the lack of Touch ID support on the Mac, and it certainly would raise the question of possible updates to Macs in the future to add Touch ID. There's been a lot of debate on how Apple could possibly do that. I've often thought they could start to build Touch ID sensors into their keyboards or their Magic trackpads, or even integrated right into the Macs themselves. I've often thought if they would ever bring the power button back, then you could put the Touch ID sensor around the power button. But I think most of the power buttons on the modern MacBooks are built into right into the keyboard. So Apple also has had a couple of patents related to building Touch ID directly into surfaces like trackpad surfaces or display surfaces. So that could be another route they could go as well. I can't imagine, you know, I think some people have also floated the idea of them building just a Touch ID, you know, like USB accessory. I guess they could do that, but it seems like it'd be better to actually integrate it into an existing product somehow. But once they do that, they could potentially enable Apple Pay Touch ID payments through Safari on the Mac. Now, Recode claims Apple is targeting having online Apple Pay payments enabled by the holidays. So it'll be a little while before we actually get our hands on this technology. And I suspect that it's something that would be revealed at this year's WWDC so that developers could start to work to integrate it into their websites and services and things like that. But always thought that Apple Pay would eventually make its way to the web. It's good to hear now that it might actually happen. At Apple's event last week, Phil Schiller also introduced some new adapters for the iPad, and we're starting to get some more information about how we can use those and how they might benefit us. One of those adapters is the Lightning to USB 3 camera adapter. It's about $39 US. And the big deal about this one is that it enables you to use USB powered accessories without the need for a separate USB hub. So we had a Lightning to USB adapter in the past, but it didn't carry any power. So if you had a powered accessory, the only way to work with it would be to actually plug a USB hub, a powered USB hub, into the adapter and then plug your devices into that. And that wasn't always convenient, especially for traveling. Now, this adapter is a little bit wider. It has the USB port along with a Lightning port that you can plug into your USB to Lightning power adapter and then get power. And what was interesting this week is Jason Snell over at his Six Colors blog tested this out for podcasting, because one of the applications is if you have a USB mic, you could use it for podcasting. And it was always a problem in the past because you'd have to carry this extra hub if you really wanted to be able to use your mic. And so he played around with it and he found some pretty good information. You can power your device and the iPad at the same time. The only thing is you have to remember that you're splitting the power. So if you've got the adapter plugged into your MacBook and you're running your powered USB mic and it's drawing 5 volts, you're not going to be able to use the 5-volt wall charger that came with your iPhone to power both your device and your USB device. You're going to need to make sure that you have like the 12-watt adapter that's going to deliver enough power to power both things. So just be aware of that. You know, make sure when you're splitting that up, you've done your math calculations right. The Lightning port on the adapter also does seem to be exclusively for power, so it's not for syncing if connected to your Mac, so you're only going to add power into the chain there. And there is a limit in that you can only really record from one source to one app at a time, meaning that only one app can have access to the microphone. You can't have, you know, the mic input going into, say, GarageBand, and then also into an application that might be running like Skype. And so whether or not it's going to be truly useful for creating an entire mobile rig for podcasting is going to really be up to Apple maybe making some changes in the software side of things so that recording's a little bit easier. You do have some of the apps like Audiobus that enables that kind of functionality in software, but currently applications like Skype don't support Audiobus. So you have to kind of find the right applications. It'd be much nicer if Apple could build some functionality right into the software to let us more easily work with audio as we move between applications or cross applications and things like that. But at the very least, with this new adapter, you should be able to do some podcasting. Another nice feature of it is that if you want to direct connect Ethernet, and this was mentioned during the keynote as well, you can get Apple's Ethernet adapter, USB to Ethernet adapter, which also requires power, and then use this adapter to directly connect an iPad or an iPhone to a hardwired network, which is pretty cool. Another accessory that Apple slipped out kind of after the keynote, it wasn't directly announced there, was the USB-C to Lightning cable. And what was exciting about this accessory is that it's believed to finally give us a way to be able to fast charge an iPad Pro 12.9. It came out not long after Apple released the iPad Pro 12.9 that it had support for up to 29 watt charging. The only issue was that the chargers that Apple supplied for USB, the biggest one is that 12 watt adapter. Now the MacBook came out and it had a 29 watt USB-C charger, but there was no USB-C to Lightning cable. Well, now that one exists, a lot of people speculated, hey, I wonder if we can finally get fast charging on the iPad Pro 12. And the good news is that it does work. Many sites this week confirmed that it works. Federico Vitici over at Mac Stories did some testing, and here's what he found. He found that the 12-watt charger included with the MacBook, or with the iPad Pro, rather, took around 3.5 hours to charge the iPad Pro 12.9. That's up to about 80%. And the reason that you only test up to 80% is just that's how the charging works. It fast charges up to 80% and then it goes into trickle charge mode to kind of do that last 20%. iOS devices have always worked that way. So he just looked at comparing, okay, what's the time from 0 to 80%? So with the 12 watt charger, around 3.5 hours. Then he tested the 29 watt adapter with the USB-C to Lightning cable and found that he reached the same charge level, 80%, in about 1 hour and 33 minutes. So quite a bit faster than using the 12 watt adapter. And that is good news for those of us who have iPad Pros because it can take a really long time. So I've had this situation come up and you've probably experienced it as well. If you have an iPad Pro 12.9, you need to leave the house in about an hour. You look at your iPad and you realize you're down at 20% battery life. Well, plugging it in for an hour isn't going to give you much charge on the 12 watts. But if you pay for the 29 watt adapter and the cable, it'll set you back about $75 US, which is quite a bit to spend. But if you're a heavy iPad Pro user, it might well be worth the investment to have faster charging. I know I'm seriously considering it's a lot of money to lay out, but if I do end up purchasing the adapter, I'll let you know how it works for me. But overall, news on the internet and through the blogs and stuff like that is this is going to be a good solution for quicker charging on the iPad Pro 12.9. And speaking of faster, larger, bigger things, what's up next for the iPhone? Well, rumors this week say that there may be a new bigger iPhone when the iPhone 7 hits. Now, this rumor was floated by a source a couple weeks ago. I think we talked about this. But now the same rumor is being spun by KGI security analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. And we know he's been pretty good with his rumors in the past. He issued a note to his investors this past week where he claimed that Apple is working on developing a new iPhone design for 2017 and that it would have a massive 5.8 inch AMOLED display. So this would not only be the first AMOLED display on an iPhone, but also the largest iPhone that Apple has ever made. I think 5.8 is taking it a little bit too far, but more on that in a second. The big news on this is really the design. He said that Apple is possibly looking to return to using a glass front and a glass back, what he called sandwich design, like they had with the iPhone 4 and 4S. It would be different, though, in the fact that it would feature curved glass on both the front and the back. And I always get confused when people start talking about curved glass on the iPhone. A lot of people think that means, oh, we're going to have a convex or a concave kind of design. But really, I think in most cases, when people are saying curved glass, they mean curved along the edges. So it's going to have rounded glass on both the front and the back. So imagine if you take the iPhone 6 design with its rounded, or 6S design with its rounded glass on the front, and have the same kind of thing on the back. Again, this is another one of those rumors that I'm not sure, so sure how I feel about it. Having more glass on your iPhone, knowing that when you drop it, the glass generally cracks, I kind of like having the metal back, because I've dropped my devices and had them luckily land in the right orientation, right? And it survives being damaged a little bit better. So if they are going to move to glass, they're going to need to make sure that it's ultra durable and doesn't crack. I guess they really didn't do that with a 4, but you know, I was happy to see that one lost. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to use glass as the primary material. There's also been rumors, and Kuo mentions this as well, that Apple's considering things like plastic or ceramic. There's been long rumors about Apple moving to a ceramic phone, but ceramic's brittle, and again, you have breakage issues, although they supposedly have developed some materials that could help with that. Ultimately, it sounds like what they're looking for is some sort of material that's easy to mold, but is also light and thin. And, you know, metal is generally cut and not really moldable, although things like liquid metal, which Apple's had a patent for a long time, is a moldable metal material. It's just been rumored they've had a rough time sort of making it work in a mass production sort of way. So regardless, we should see, and you know, it's time for a pretty significant design change with respect to the iPhone 7. It sounds like that might be coming. A few other features he mentions Apple is looking at potentially including in an updated iPhone model. Wireless charging. This is one of those things that I'm a little bit ambivalent on as well, because when you think about it, wireless charging as it exists today really still requires that you put your device on top of something. So it's really not all that different than connecting a cable, at least in my mind. And the other disadvantage wireless charging has is, what happens if you want to charge and use the device at the same time? If you look at the Apple Watch's magnetic, you know, wireless charger, it doesn't stick on there really well. You can't really pick up your Apple Watch and use it at the same time you have it charging. And the same would be true of an iPhone. And how many of us have been in that situation where you're low on battery, you pull out your power cable, you plug in, and you're using the device as a wired device? To lose that ability, I don't think would be a great thing. But if Apple keeps the port and adds wireless charging, I guess it could work where you can use Lightning when you want and wireless charging when you want, and that could be a good compromise. The other thing he mentions is additional biometric security, possibly iris scanning or facial recognition. So I would assume you could hold your iPhone up to your face and then it would magically unlock. I still think the user experience for that is a little bit odd. I'm happy with the Touch ID. It's super fast. I put my thumb on there. I don't really notice it. I'm holding my device anyway. If I have to take an extra step of actually holding the camera up and doing some sort of selfie kind of facial recognition unlocking, that just seems a little bit awkward. But that's another one of these things that's been rumored about for a while. And in Kuo's piece, he also cites the fact that Apple recently acquired facial technology companies like Emotient and the real-time 3D rendering firm FaceShift. And one of the rumors was that Apple has developed a 3D sort of modeling technology that adds more accuracy to the whole facial recognition security system. So they could be looking at that. I think that would be something that would be maybe more appropriate for Mac, where you've got the face or the EyeSight camera. FaceTime camera. I'm always getting those mixed up. The FaceTime camera on the front of the device, I can walk up to my Mac and magically be logged in without actually having to do any other credentials. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And maybe that's the biometric they could use, now that I'm thinking about it, for things like Apple Pay in the future. So they wouldn't have to build a Touch ID sensor in. They could use facial recognition as the authentication for making Apple Pay payments. Now, with this much larger size, the question becomes, is this going to be a new model, or is this going to be an update to the 5.5 inch plus size model that Apple currently has? Quo kind of thinks it could go either way, and it may depend on Apple's ability to get the 5.8 inch panels. That's another thing that has been eluding Apple from moving to an AMOLED display in the past. Basically, their suppliers really can't supply the number of panels that Apple would need for a major iPhone launch, although it's been rumored that many of them have been looking at ramping up production. So if they can produce enough displays, it would be released, in Quo's opinion, as a update or a new version to replace the 5.5 inch model. But it also could wind up as an add-on model, a new higher-end model that Apple could make available. Originally, Quo did not see Apple making an AMOLED iPhone until 2019. He had put that out in prior sort of notes, but sounds like it's changing a little bit, and maybe those suppliers have worked up enough production where they can actually serve Apple's needs here in 2017. So he is expecting the larger iPhone to make a debut this year, and we'll just have to wait and see if that comes to be. But, you know, for me, I tried the 5.5 inch plus, as you know, and it was just too big for me. I'm back with the iPhone 6, so I can't even imagine going to a 5.8, but there are a lot of consumers out there who really like the really, really large phones, like the Galaxy Note, right? Is that what it's called? Or is it just called the Note? I'm not really up on my Samsung phones, but, you know, the super big one that a lot of people really like. But be curious to get your opinion. Do you want an even bigger iPhone? What do you think? Shoot me some email, mattcast@gmail.com. Last week, Apple updated iOS to iOS version 9.3. It came with some great new features like the ability to secure notes and Apple's new night shift feature. But not everybody is having a good time with iOS 9.3. It is causing some trouble for some iOS device owners, specifically users of older devices like the iPad 2. They found that after upgrading, they would get stuck in the activation lock screen and were basically locked out of their devices. It basically bricked their phones. The issue seems to affect iPhone 5S and earlier models, as well as iPad Air and earlier models of iPads. And Apple this week put out a patch to fix the issue. So if your device got stuck, what you're going to want to do is connect your device to iTunes, download the latest version of the update, and install that, and that should get you past the bug. So Apple did recognize the problem and has issued a fix. Now, that's one fix, but there also appears to be a second bug that has also been acknowledged by Apple but is not quite fixed yet, and that is a bug that can cause apps to crash and freeze when attempting to open up hyperlinks. The issue seems to be related to a technology in iOS called Universal Links. These are the links that allow app developers to basically register domain names or register links that when you click them on an iOS device within an app or from inside Safari, if the developer's app is installed, it will actually open up the link inside the app rather than opening up Safari and going to the device. There seems to be a problem with those kinds of links, at least with some apps. Some indication that it's apps where they have a very large universal link database built in, and what'll happen is basically that'll crash and freeze the app or lock up your device, and I think in some cases it even locks up Safari. So if you've run into that issue, I think you have to either reboot the device or actually quit the app and relaunch it. Apple is aware of the issue. They're currently working on a fix, but no ETA has been given as to when that will be released. So overall, I was able to upgrade to iOS 9.3. I haven't been affected by either of these issues, but I do have a newer iPhone and newer iPads, so that may just be luck of the draw. If you have run into those issues, you've got a fix for one, and on the other one, just wait a little bit. Really, I think the only thing you can do is sort of avoid clicking those kinds of links. There's not really any way, unfortunately, to identify if the link is going to cause this problem, but I guess avoid links and apps altogether. That's probably not very good advice or very plausible, but I guess one way to go. Hopefully Apple will issue the fix relatively quickly. In case you missed it, I may have buried the lead a little bit this week because we've been talking so much about the Department of Justice and FBI case against Apple trying to get them to unlock this iPhone in the case of the San Bernardino terrorists shooting. And on Monday, the DOJ moved to actually vacate or basically dismiss the issued court order that was going to compel Apple to help them hack the iPhone belonging to the suspect in that shooting case. And the reason is that, as we reported last week, there was a hearing that was set. They were getting ready to hear the appeal that Apple was making to kind of contest the court order. But the DOJ and the FBI said, hey, we need a delay because we think we found a way to actually get into the device without Apple's help. And they had been maintaining that only Apple could help them actually crack the iPhone. Well, they found a third party and some sort of technique that was going to let them unlock it. They gave them a delay of the trial to try it and see if it was going to work. Turns out it did work. That doesn't mean it's over for Apple. In the case of many other devices, the government and law enforcement are still trying to get access to those. So there's still a number of other ongoing cases, but at least in this one case, they have, you know, issued an order to vacate, which basically means they're dropping the court order. They're not going to follow up on the court order. And they did say, quote, it remains a priority for the government to ensure that law enforcement can obtain crucial digital information to protect national security and public safety, either with cooperation from relevant parties or through the court system when cooperation fails. And that came from a DOJ spokesperson. So just because it worked this one time doesn't mean that's always going to be the route that they pursue, and they could come back. They're basically saying and ask for Apple's cooperation, and if they don't want to cooperate again, they'll go through the court system again. So not really changing. Now, as far as how they were able to crack into this phone, they're not saying, and they're not saying whether they will say or they won't say. Apple has already stated that they would really like to know the technique, but it's probably not likely to happen. The government has not said what, if any, information it would be willing to give up or give over to Apple. There's been some debate that in the case of these other cases where the government or law enforcement is trying to compel Apple to open phones through court orders, that Apple could request as part of their defense information. Whether or not the government would be required to give that up is really unclear at this point. But, you know, I, for one, personally would really love to know what's going on. Now, I have seen a number of reports and a lot of people who are concerned that, hey, does that mean my iPhone is less secure than I really thought? And while we don't know for sure, my guess is because the technique that the FBI was going after was just an ability to bypass some of the passcode locks and the lockouts that would happen for invalid passcode attempts. The assumption is that this San Bernardino phone had a four-digit simple security code and that they simply cracked that through brute force. So probably there's not a huge security hole or a zero-day exploit that was used. We don't know that with 100% certainty, but you know, logic dictates that's probably not the case. Probably the issue with this one phone was it just had a simple four-digit passcode. And without the other protections that Apple has put in place in terms of the security lockouts, if those are bypassed, the ability to brute force a four-digit code is pretty trivial. It takes about 30 minutes or so to do that if those other control mechanisms aren't in place. So your best protection is make sure that you're using not a simple passcode, but a complex passcode that's using alphanumeric characters, and it's longer than longer than six digits. I would say make it 8, 10, 12 digits, and you'll be pretty secure, because even if they can bypass those safeguards, it's going to take years for anybody to be able to brute force crack your device. So just be aware of that. As far as what the technique is, the FBI did say, and I think we talked about this last week, that they did not use the NAND mirroring technique that many security professionals speculated they might use. So that even raises more concern that maybe this is some sort of zero-day exploit or some sort of hole in the security that Apple doesn't know about. But another thing that could happen is if a trial ultimately results from evidence collected via this technique, I guess it could possibly come out because the defense would have to be able to validate the technique that was used and that information would have to be given up. I don't know if they could put like a gag order on that or something to better protect it, because really the government wants to safeguard that technique because they want to be able to probably use it again in some of the other ongoing cases that they have. Now, Apple issued a statement following all of this saying that they believed the case never should have been brought and that they would continue to work on increasing the security of their products. So we can all be prepared for more fights on this on more fronts, both from the FBI side and Apple. There's going to be other, you know, single iPhone cases that are brought. We know of hundreds of them in various states and through the federal government, as well as local governments and authority agencies. Apple is going to seek what the FBI and the DOJ calls warrant-proof technology. They're going to try and find ways where they're going to be able to lock down and better protect and encrypt our devices where Apple doesn't have the keys. They don't have ways to actually build in backdoors. We've already heard about Apple's plans to change iCloud encryption so they can't use the iCloud hole that they had been to give up data and information with when they get requested for it. They're also looking to build their own cloud and take that out of the hands of some of the third-party developers, bring that more in control. And they've already reportedly been transitioning their security operations, and they're breaking down their general product security team into smaller groups that are going to cover things like encryption, anonymity, and other privacy issues. So Apple is dead serious about security and privacy in their products. They have been for years, and it sounds like they're continuing to push forward. And this case may have just accelerated their drive to actually, you know, build in more security and controls that are quote unquote warrant proof. And now that sounds like a good thing, but it's also could be a catch 22 for us because the government is already supposedly writing proposals and laws that are trying to force companies to assist law enforcement in accessing computers and devices. And they're proposing outlawing the kind of warrant proof spaces that Apple is talking about creating. And we've already seen some of this legislation being proposed. It's working its way through the system. And if that were to go through, then we could end up with a situation where companies are forced or required to build in backdoors for law enforcement. And of course, the concern there is that a backdoor is not exclusive to any one party. Just because it's there for government use, it's eventually and will likely get out as a way that criminals and other nefarious parties could use the same exploit. So, you know, the fear is that we could be left with fewer checks and balances over our civil liberties, and that the continued privacy and security of our data and devices would ultimately be at risk if this is kind of the path we go down. So it's going to be very important for all of us, especially as geeks and nerds and people who are concerned about these issues, to kind of stay on top of what's going on, to have communication with our local senators and policy officials and people who are working on this legislation and let them know what our feelings are. And either way, you know, if you think it's a good thing that, you know, devices shouldn't be able to be locked down in such a way where government and people can't get at the underlying data, then you support that. If you're on the side of, no, I think we should have all the security and privacy that we want to have as private citizens for our devices and our stuff, then, you know, be on that side as well. Support either side. But for sure, all of us are going to need to get more involved in this issue if we really care about it. And, you know, I'm more on the side where I think it's important for our devices to be secure and private, and for government not to be able to just get in there whenever they want. They have other mechanisms and ways for doing that. But that's just my personal opinion. You don't have to agree with me, and I'm sure many of you don't. We've even had some conversations on Twitter and in other places where I know that to be the case. But certainly this fight isn't over, and it's going to be ongoing. And we'll just try and stay on top of it and keep you informed in hopefully as neutral a way as possible, so that you can make your own informed decisions about where or which side of these issues you fall on. Apple has a whole new look for its retail stores, and they've been slowly rolling that out. The first store actually featuring the new design opened in Brussels, I think, earlier this year, and then that was followed by a store in Albany, New York. But this week, a third store came with the updated design. It opened up in Memphis, Tennessee, and one of the main features of the new design is Apple's getting rid of a lot of their backlit panel displays that are typically on the sides of the store, and they're replacing that with a massive 37-foot video display, supposedly designed by Johnny Ive and rumored to cost about $1.5 million each. And that display will just rotate different product advertisements and promotions and images and things like that. They look incredible. Not really sure all the details on the features. I'd love to see one up close and in person, but they almost look like they wrap. I don't think they actually wrap around, but almost looks like a seamless black monolithic kind of box and displays these massive, beautiful images. But another thing that the stores feature are more granite, more wood. I think they're using a new kind of wood on the tables that's a little bit darker. They have those tables, especially I think in the Genius Bar area, that have the motion activated flip up access in the middle. So you wave your hand kind of over the middle back of the table and the power ports flip around and pop up, so you can plug in USB or power as you're working at the table. They also redesigned the area where you get all your accessories into something they're calling the Avenue. And Angela Arendts says it's designed more so that the drawers and cabinets and other interactive things are designed to kind of simulate the feel of walking down a street outside and just doing a little bit of window shopping. So they have, you know, like these cool sort of, not so much heads, but these round things where like all the headphones are, so you can try on all the headphones. And a lot of the accessories are displayed kind of on a wall, and then they're actually attached to drawers that pull out from behind the display so that you can get at Apple's cases and Apple Watch straps and all those sorts of things. It looks really, really nice and sort of interactive. They've got these accessory and pull-out shelves and things like that that allow you to more easily access things, but not only that, actually display the products in a way where you can kind of see what everything looks like and see what's actually in the packaging. So I really kind of like the new store design. I haven't been to New York or Tennessee to check it out, or even Brussels for that matter. I don't get over to Europe too often. But if you have been in one of these stores and had a chance to try out and kind of see how the new flow and design works, let us know, and maybe how that compares to the existing Apple Store design. Shoot us some email and feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, you know, the iPhone SE and the iPad Pro 9.5, those went on sale on the 24th. They're being released on the 31st and should be in Apple retail stores. I plan to try and head out and get my hands on and take a look at the actual products themselves. But it looks like, as far as sales go, they seem to be off to a solid start. We don't have numbers from the US yet, but pre-order estimates in China were at 3.4 million units over the weekend. Not quite the same as Apple does, say, with an iPhone 6S or 6S Plus launch, but still not bad. And more importantly, the device may be helping Apple reach previously unreached customers. Slice Intelligence did a little analysis of the opening weekend sales and found some interesting things. They say that only about 35% of the people purchasing the iPhone SE online had actually purchased a new iPhone within the past 2 years, meaning that it's looking like more buyers are likely new or customers who are finally upgrading a device that they bought 2 years ago or more. So It's definitely having an impact with those people who maybe haven't upgraded yet or people coming to the iPhone for the first time. They also found that 16% of buyers were switching from Android, and that's up from about 10% on average for other iPhone launches. So it does seem to be having more of an impact or more of an appeal to switchers, and that's ultimately a good thing for Apple in the long run. Anytime they can win more customers over from Android and other platforms is going to be good for Apple's bottom line. And so far, they've just launched in a few countries, but they're getting set to launch in 47 other countries starting April 4th and 5th. So the numbers are going to only grow larger. A lot of analysts thinking that this is going to add another 10 million to maybe 15 million in iPhone sales this year for Apple just with the iPhone SE. And there's been a lot of positive spin and buzz around the iPad Pro 9.7. A lot of people excited about that. I've even seen some people saying with both these products that they're considering, I wouldn't even call it a downgrade because these products are really, you know, the iPhone SE is basically an iPhone 6S just in a smaller package. And with the iPad Pro 9.7, same thing. It's an iPad Pro, you know, 12.9 in a smaller form factor. And I've seen a number of people saying, you know what, I think I want to move down to the smaller size. I have an iPad Pro 12.9 or I have an iPhone 6S or even a 6S Plus. And really, I think the smaller form factor is for me. So it's going to be interesting to see the number of people that actually switch over from an already existing Apple product that's larger down to the smaller size. And I've heard from some of you, I'd love to hear from some more if you're planning on doing just that. And if you do get one of these new products, let us know what you think, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, if you need to build a website, it can be a time-consuming, a costly, and sometimes frustrating process. And it just seems to get more and more complicated as more new technologies come out, as more things are going on. It can be turn out to be a hassle. And it's not just the code. It's having to think about things like mobile designs and making sure that you're mobile responsive and that you have search engine optimization and social media integration. And what if you want to do e-commerce? I mean, setting up a shopping cart and doing payment processing, it can all get a little bit overwhelming, but that's exactly where Squarespace comes in, because they can take away a lot of that complexity. They can give you a great looking website and they can get you up and running quickly at a very affordable price. It means that you can stay focused on the things that you work on, your company, your team, your business, the projects that you work on. You know, we're not all web developers. We're not all people who want to do the programming, right? You just want to run your business, but you also want to have a great looking website that looks good for all of your customers, reaches the people you want, and gives you great marketing. And Squarespace sites give you all of that. They have everything that you need and great support to go along with it. They can give you the hosting and a free domain if you sign up for a year, so they take care of that. They have great looking templates that are designed for all sorts of businesses, and all of them are mobile ready, so they'll look great on the desktop and on all of your mobile devices. They have the ability to fully customize the site with easy drag and drop tools. Or if you do want to get more technical, if you are into that technical geeky stuff, you can go straight to the code and you can work that way as well. They have great features and options like Typekit support, so you get great fonts, Google fonts. You have the ability to do lightbox images and galleries, so if you want to display photos and photo galleries. And they bring social tools and integration as well, so Twitter, Facebook, all of that stuff, podcast support, website metrics so that you can keep track of it. And they also have options that fully support integrated e-commerce, payment processing, professional email from Google. You can run your entire business with a Squarespace website, and they do make it really easy. And best of all, you can try it for free. You can start your free trial today by going to squarespace.com/maccast. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, you can use the offer code MACCAST to get 10% off your first purchase. They make it truly easy and convenient to build a great looking website. And I think I've mentioned before, I mean, if this isn't a endorsement, I don't know what is. I'm a web developer. I'm a programmer. I've done this for 20 years and I use Squarespace to build some of my websites as well, just because they make it so simple and easy. So check them out. Get your free trial started today at squarespace.com/Maccast. Because of this whole Apple FBI thing over the last couple weeks, I've been having to do something that's not one of my favorite things to do, and that is talk about legal things. If you've listened to the show for a long time, you'll probably notice that I tend to avoid the stories that deal with lawsuits and ongoing legal action against Apple or that Apple is taking against other companies. And one of the reasons for that is I'm just really not interested in it. The other thing is I often very often don't understand the legal stuff. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do on the MacCast is break things down and explain things for you and clear and simple and easy terms. It's something that I like to do. But because I'm not really interested in a lot of legal stuff, I'm not interested in taking the time to dig down that far to give myself the understanding. So let me just say that I am not a lawyer and I don't pretend to even play one on this podcast, but because I've been covering it, I'm sure at least one of you, or maybe some of you have noticed, I don't always necessarily get the terminology right, but luckily for me, one of you who is a lawyer was kind enough to email me and point out a couple errors in the terminology that I made as I was covering the Apple versus FBI case. And I thought in the interest of setting things right, I would share with you what I learned from his email. It starts out with I think the best way for me to do this is explain exactly what happened in all the steps of the case and just correct any errors I might have made in the past. So ignore all that stuff that I said in the past. No, not quite that. But what I'm really looking to do here is sort of clear up any confusion in the terminology, or more specifically, sort of the actions and steps that were taken. I think what I really mixed up was, you know, different terms and saying, like, you know, that Apple issue or the FBI issued a court order or gave a court order, whatever I said, it wasn't quite the right terminology. So really what happened was the FBI filed against Apple was a civil complaint seeking evidence in this particular case, this iPhone in San Bernardino. And the government then filed what's called a motion seeking to compel Apple to assist them by creating what we now are commonly referring to as government OS. That was a term that actually Apple made up in one of its responses, saying the government wants us to create this specialized version of iOS that's going to allow them to hack this iPhone, basically bypassing some of the security controls that we built into iOS. So we're going to call this thing government OS. So they filed a motion seeking to have Apple basically create government OS. And then what happened from that filing is the court reviewed it and the court issued an order from a judge citing the All Writs Act as the reason for the order being issued, or the justification. And that order was going to compel Apple to help the FBI and to create this government OS. And then in response to that, Apple filed their own motion seeking to vacate that order, basically have that order be dropped. And that was the thing that was going to go to trial up until this past week, and go to a judge and go to the court, and then everybody was going to be able to make their case, and then the judge would ultimately rule or decide if that order should be vacated or if it should stand and go forward. And then, again, based on that ruling, what could possibly happen is Apple could then appeal to another court and so on and so on. But basically, I think what we're trying to resolve is that parties file complaints and motions requesting relief or requesting that something happen in a case. And then the court system, usually through the action of a presiding judge, issues various orders. And then the orders that are issued can then be appealed, which is what Apple did until you know, the trial delay happened. And then finally, after a hearing or trial, there's ultimately a ruling or a decision, and that decision could then in turn be appealed. And then, you know, it goes back to, here we are in the appeal. There's going to be another trial, and then there'll be another ruling, and so on, all the way up until, I would assume this ultimately would have gone all the way probably to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court would have sort of final say on this. But in this case, as mentioned earlier, the order is no longer needed because the DOJ actually issued a motion, and I'm going to get the terminology right this time because I understand it. They issued a motion to vacate or basically drop the original court order. I don't know if it's nullified or what. Again, I'm probably getting my terms all mixed up. So if you hear this again and you're the person who sent me this original email, correct me again. But, you know, basically, the DOJ issued the motion this time to vacate the order because they didn't need it anymore, and the court ultimately granted that motion. So Apple's not going to have to worry about this particular case anymore, but as I mentioned earlier, there's going to be plenty of others. So I really appreciate the person who sent in this information and allowed me to kind of get my terminology straightened up. And hopefully this clears things up for you as well, at least until I'm mutilated again next time, which will probably happen, but at least I'm straightened out for right now. So last week's update of iOS 9.3 brought in the new night shift feature to iOS. And just as a refresher, in case you missed it, the night shift feature is the thing that allows the display on your iOS device to gradually shift its color space from a cooler blue light spectrum to more warmer tones in the evening. And the main idea behind the concept of doing this is that it's been found that the artificial blue light that comes from LEDs, basically the LED backlight in your display, that can negatively impact our natural sleep patterns. So it has an impact on melatonin levels and can cause some people, or most people, I think, to not be able to get to sleep because you're being bombarded by that light. And as we use our devices more and more in the evening, a lot of people think that this is affecting our sleep patterns. And getting regular amounts of sleep, yes, is good for anyone's health. A lot of us geeks don't do it. We don't sleep enough. I'll be the first to admit it. But it's not only good for anyone's health. There are specific segments of the population where it's actually critical. And I did not realize this, but Mike wrote me this week to say that the night shift feature is even more important for him than most of Apple's customers. And he says it's because he suffers from epilepsy and he has to pay really close attention to his sleep patterns. Apparently, lack of sleep can be a trigger mechanism for people who have epilepsy. And so he's constantly monitoring it. So he was saying, he was just writing to tell me he was very happy that Apple actually added this feature to iOS because, you know, it's very important to his health, more so than almost anyone else. And I would imagine, too, that there's other conditions and medical conditions that could benefit from this feature being built into the operating system. And we know that Apple has always had a focus on accessibility. They've been, you know, one of the leaders in their industry for doing that. And many, many people with disabilities are Apple users because of Apple's support for these kinds of technologies. And more recently, with health, we've seen, you know, things like Apple's health app and technologies like ResearchKit and CareKit. Apple is getting more and more into the health field. So I have to imagine that when Apple was considering adding the night shift feature, Mike, that maybe this even came as part of their decision process, saying, you know what, there's a lot of medical people with medical conditions that could benefit from this technology, and we're going to go ahead and build it in. And so I want to thank you for writing me to point that out, because I really had no idea or had really paused to think about, hey, this might be beneficial just outside the realm of, you know, your average Apple consumer. And I'll also say, you know, I commented on Night Shift. I made some probably disparaging comments about it because I think the color is a little bit shocking. But I've been using it now for, you know, a week or so, and I have to say I'm becoming more comfortable with the night shift technology. I have it set up to auto-activate at sunrise and sunset, or I guess it's activate at sunset and deactivate at sunrise. But I've been able to use it, and I'm actually getting used to it. I'm enjoying it. It doesn't look so shocking at night when I pick up my iPhone and it's more in those warm tones. I can still tell it's there. I still know it's happening, and I know I can adjust it down a little bit. But I don't want to, you know, minimize the benefits that I might be getting from it. Now, the one area where I do bypass it though manually through the control center is when I'm watching movies or TV shows at night. And every time I do it, I think, well, maybe I'm totally defeating the purpose here. I'm flipping it over and now I'm getting bombarded with that blue light, and it's going to keep me up all night and just make my insomnia even worse. But if I'm reading or browsing or doing something like that, I go ahead and leave it on, and I guess I get the benefits at that time. But I'm curious to hear from others. If you're using Night Shift, do you like it? Do you not like it? On the Mac, it's not built into OS X yet, but you do have the ability to download and install Flux, which was kind of the first application that really made me aware of this kind of technology and the need for it. And a lot of people kind of felt that maybe Apple was copying Flux, and we had that whole issue where Flux actually built an application that would work on iOS, and Apple blocked it because they were not distributing it through the App Store at large. They were kind of back channeling it using a developer technology, and that's just not allowed by Apple's app rules. But many saw it as them blocking it because Apple knew they were building the Night Shift technology themselves into the operating system. But however you fall on that side of things, I think this is good technology for us to have built into our device, and even more so now that I know it's helping guys like Mike with some serious medical conditions. So again, thanks, Mike, for sending in your email. Last week, I talked a little bit about some updates to Apple's News app, and I gave you some of my thoughts and comments on the News app itself. I had not initially been using it very much, and I'm starting to find I'm using it more and more for kind of exploring and just finding articles, you know, more casual reading, maybe Sunday morning when I'm sitting down with a cup of coffee. And I asked for some of your feedback and comments, and I also talked a little bit about RSS reading versus using the Apple News app, and mentioned that, you know, I like RSS because it gives me the ability to kind of control the content that I want coming in and filter it a little bit more, as opposed to something like the News app, where I just pick general broad categories or specific sites and stuff like that and get news and content all kind of mixed together. And Gary actually responded. He sent this little audio review of another potential application that may combine the best of both of those worlds.
Hey, Adam. It's Gary. I have been using Early Edition for, I don't know how many years, maybe 5 years, maybe longer. It works really well. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it creates like a little magazine style view of all of your RSS feeds, and you can pick other things, like, you know, from a list of curated categories, technology, home, you know, fashion, whatever it is that you're interested in. Pick as many things as you want, add as many things as you want, import other RSS links from, you know, if you follow things on your web browser, or I think at the time that Google had their reader or whatever, you could import from there. So I've been using Early Edition for a long time, and you basically every day you get delivered a curated paper of everything that you follow, and then you flick the pages. You can click on the individual articles and it opens up. I really like that format. It feels like a newspaper, or it feels like a magazine. Maybe it's kind of like a Flipboard, but this has been attractive to me because it like strips out all of these extra graphics. It gives me only like key critical pictures. If you click on the articles, you can click on like different things that strip out graphics and ads, and you get just the core article, which I think is an advantage. When I go into Apple's new News, it is nice. There's seems to be more endless content besides, you know, from my early edition, there is a beginning, a middle, and an end. It just only sources so much material at the time you get your paper generated. If you regenerate the paper at the end of the day, you'll get a little bit more because articles are being written all the time. And on Apple News, you can keep scrolling and scrolling forever, and you just got to pick your time when you're done reading. So, but when you are in there, you get the article, then you click again, then you have to click to read more, and you kind of get pushed into a web browser, and you get, you know, various different ad things inside there. I just want to be able to, like, see the article, not all of this extra stuff, and I feel like that's a disadvantage to the Apple News. But maybe I'm missing something. Maybe there is a way that you can click reader mode and it like strips that out and just lets you read the article. Oftentimes I'm having my phone or iPad read me the articles and stuff, and that is much easier when you have just the core text. So that's some of my thoughts on the news application. Thanks.
Hey, Gary, thanks for the feedback as always. I had not run across the early edition application, but it looks pretty neat. Yeah, gives you that sort of Apple News format with your own feeds kind of driving the content. So I'm definitely going to play around with that a little bit. If you want to check out the early edition app, I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. But I'd also thought I'd throw in a couple other items related to this. I actually use and also like an application called Newsify. And it gives you the option for either a newspaper sort of magazine-like view of your RSS feeds or a more traditional table-style list. Now, I've been using it on my iPhone more in the traditional mode, but I would imagine, and I haven't really played with this too much, that I might actually also really like using it in the newspaper format on my iPad, especially my iPad Pro 12.9. You know, again, it gives you that little bit more newspaper-like feel. Sounds like it would be very similar to your early edition, Gary. And as far as driving all of that, people will often ask me, well, how do you manage your RSS feeds? How do you make sure as you're moving between your Mac and different devices that everything stays in sync? And I've tried a number of different services. I tried Feedbin in the past, which is a service that'll allow you to do this. It's a paid for service, but ultimately ended up on Feedly, which is a free service that lets you keep all of your RSS feeds in sync. And it also gives me the ability to quickly star or favorite certain articles for review later. And I think I've done a whole episode on this, but real briefly, when I'm prepping the MacCast, I have to go through hundreds of articles a day. And so very often what I do is I do sort of a quick culling or a quick editing of all of the news stories for a given day. And I just sort of quickly flag and star articles that I think I'm going to want to come back and include in the show. And what Feedly allows me to do is allows me to go back to my RSS reader and then go to the starred section, and I can see all of the articles go in, and then I can read through just those ones and start to build out the show notes and the content for each week's show. So that's kind of how I do it, and I use Feedly to drive all of that. And then one other thing that I'll do through Newsify or whatever RSS application that I'm using is I also use the integration with a service like Pocket to save off links or articles, more long-form articles that I want to read, or maybe things that are just videos, because Pocket has great support for just video content, stuff that I want to come back and watch later. So maybe I don't have time to read through that. You know, I can read through a quick article that's maybe a couple paragraphs, but if it's something that's going to be a couple pages, I'll typically flag that, throw that into the Pocket service, and then come back inside the Pocket application and read through those. And again, that's another one of my sort of Sunday morning rituals, or when I have time to more sit down and just enjoy some content more for personal reasons, I'll use Pocket for that. So that's kind of how I go through articles and keeping up on the news and stuff like that. And again, like I said, I am kind of throwing Apple News into the mix a little bit more, but I still am struggling with that a little bit to kind of figure out what's the workflow that really works for me there, just because it is so kind of disjointed. And I agree with you, Gary. You know, one of my biggest frustrations is not, and I think I mentioned this in the last episode, is that not every article on Apple News is a full article. Very often you'll get just the first part of it, and then you'll actually need to flip over to a web view. And at that point, I kind of feel, well, if I wanted to, you know, view this website, you know, this website's content on their website, I just would have fired it up in Safari and consumed it that way. So what's the point of even throwing it into the news application if the experience isn't going to be different? But thank you so much for your review of Early Edition. And again, if you want to check any of these things out, I'll have the show notes, the links in the show notes at maccast.com. I mentioned the iOS 9.3 update earlier. Apple also updated last week the operating system for the fourth generation Apple TV. They issued tvOS 2.2, and it brought things like folders and support for Siri dictation. But a number of you emailed me to express frustration at a change that it seems Apple made, and that is that you no longer can place your finger on the trackpad and scrub through video as you're watching a movie or a TV show or something like that. You can still tap the side of the surface to skip forward, or, you know, the trackpad, or click the side of the trackpad rather, the left or the right side, to either skip forward or backward 10 seconds. But simply swiping on the trackpad no longer seems to do anything. And a number of people were saying, oh, Apple's removed the ability to scrub in videos, and that would be horrible. And I was like, I can't imagine that that is possible. And luckily, it looks like the scrubbing feature wasn't totally removed as much as it was just changed, or the way that you interact with it or access it is changed. And I have a guess as to why they actually did this, because I was constantly getting frustrated, and I think I also got emails from many of you about this as well, that when I got the new Apple TV, I would go to pick up the remote and either pick it up upside down or backwards, or accidentally brush or touch the trackpad, and suddenly you're scrubbing the video in whatever you're watching, which is really not what you want. And we also have a cat, and the cat will often walk or step on the remote just as we're sitting there watching TV, and suddenly it's scrubbing and doing weird things. So I think what Apple did was change how this works so that you didn't have those accidental presses. We did cover the tip, you know, if you accidentally scrub to the wrong place in a video, or scrub accidentally, you can quickly press the menu button before you actually jump to that point, and it will actually return to the original place in the video from before you did the scrubbing. But you may not have to do that any longer after this change, because it now seems that Apple has implemented a two-step procedure for scrubbing. What you have to do is first press the play pause button, or I've also found that you can simply click on the trackpad button and that will pause your video, but pause the video first, then put your finger on the trackpad to scrub to the location you want, and then click the trackpad button again to jump to that point in your video. And that will allow you to do scrubbing. So scrubbing is still there. It's just a little bit different how you need to interact with it. And the other thing, and I'm guilty of forgetting this too, but don't forget, you can always use Siri voice control with the new Apple TV to, you know, control video scrubbing, or basically jump to any point in your video. You just click the Siri button on the remote and say something like, skip back 30 seconds or jump forward 2 minutes. And it will automatically do that. And sometimes that can be a little bit faster than just trying to find the position visually. I mean, if you know, hey, I just missed something someone said, or I stepped away and I was gone about a minute and a half, hey, tap the Siri button, jump back a minute and a half, or jump back 1 minute and 30 seconds, and Siri will automatically do that for you, which is really convenient. I'm trying to use the Siri functionality on my Apple TV a little bit more. It's taken, just like Siri on the iPhone, I think, it takes sort of forcing yourself to continue to use it before you can kind of get proficient at it or get more comfortable with it. But as I've gotten more comfortable with using that functionality, I'm really starting to enjoy it more and more. So give that a try. And just wanted to point out, you know, the scrubbing thing, because a lot of people seem to be really frustrated by that. And then finally, in the MacCast for today, one other thing I want to talk to you about is Liam. And in case you don't know who or what Liam is, you maybe missed Apple's last event keynote, But they talked about one of their R&D projects, which is this robot, and they've nicknamed him Liam. And I think he was one of the coolest things at the Apple event. But basically, he's a robot that can disassemble an iPhone 6S in 11 seconds. And the reason he's a iPhone-destroying robot is Apple wanted a way to be able to quickly separate an iPhone into its component parts so that those parts could be reused or recycled. It's part of their environmental efforts. They're working on this robot. I don't think he's in deployment yet, but I think Apple is planning on doing something with him. My initial speculation was that Apple would build some sort of amazing army of Liam robots in a factory somewhere and have them quickly disassembling iPhones that were turned in through its iPhone recycling programs, right? But Michael emailed me with another really cool thought, something that I hadn't thought about, is that, you know, rather than having an army of Liams all in one place, what if you had sort of an army of Liams, one or two at a time, deployed all over the planet? Specifically, what if Liam was a genius robot working at an Apple retail store, sort of in the back of the house, right? So when a customer comes in to upgrade or trade in an old iPhone, they could take it in the back and Liam would happily be there. They could load it into the machine. He would happily disassemble and separate the parts into their respective pieces. And then periodically, you know, Apple could just ship off the component parts, which actually might cost a little bit less in terms of shipping, ship off the individual component parts to be recycled or reused. And as a matter of fact, I would imagine for things like screws or little, replaceable parts, they might even be able to use them right there in the store for other repairs. So that actually could save Apple some time. And I don't know how many, you know, iPhones they get in through their program at each retail store on any given day, but you could, you know, probably handle the volume if you're doing that on site one at a time or a few at a time, something like that. And I thought that was a really interesting thought. But then Michael took it even one step further and said, hey, you know, what if Liam didn't fully disassemble the phone or have to fully disassemble the phone? What if it could be programmed for different kinds of repairs and it could actually help or assist the staff or the geniuses at the Apple retail store in doing iPhone repairs? So imagine that, you know, you need to do a screen replacement. What if Liam could do all the steps up to and including removing the old screen, and then the human partner could take it from there. They could hand it off. They could replace the screen, reassemble the phone, and then give it back to the customer all without having to go to a central facility. It could really help extend and speed up in-house repairs. It could also potentially limit any losses Apple might have from damage that could occur during disassembly of a phone. If you've ever done a repair on an iPad or an iPhone or something like that, you know a lot of those cables can be really delicate and you pull the wrong way or do the wrong thing and suddenly you've broken something that wasn't broken before. And I would imagine that geniuses even suffer from that. You make one little slip or you cough or sneeze at the wrong time and suddenly you've broken something. So to think that, hey, here's a robot that can quickly get you to the point where you can do the repair and then just finish it up, it really could speed up and extend Apple's ability to do more repairs in-house. I don't know if Liam has those capabilities, but I thought it was an interesting point. And if he could do the reassembly, that would be even better, but it's not clear that he can do that yet, but might be something that Apple's actually working on. I thought it was a really great idea, and it wasn't something that I had immediately considered, but that's what I love about doing this show and having this community is that folks like, you know, Michael and Gary and everybody else who contributes and sends in their thoughts and ideas, we all have this kind of collective consciousness that we can draw off of. And I really appreciate everyone for sending in their comments and feedback. So related to that, I think we're going to be finishing up the show here. And before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all their great software. Get more information and details at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to Gazelle.com. macfly.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on that MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. As I mentioned, I love getting your feedback, your comments, your questions. If you have a topic you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or you just have a comment about this episode or any other episode, you can shoot those emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And also, don't forget, you can leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype username is TheMacCast. You can call there and leave your voicemails and maybe save on long-distance charges, especially if you're out of the country. Although, I don't know if anybody really has long-distance charges anymore. Do we? If we're using our cell phones, I think maybe we do. I don't know. But take advantage of that. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's a great place to ask questions and get help with your technology and Mac and iOS questions. So please take advantage of that as well. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the Fast MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, and you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community at google.com/plusmaccast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.